These are countries that desperately need infrastructure, desperately need technology, and desperately need trade partners, right, to capitalize on their exports. So this is crucial in terms of not just their finances, but obviously that translates to diplomacy, that translates to favors down the road.
The Manhattan Project allowed the United States to defeat Nazi Germany.
We're going to be doing one thing and one thing only, killing Nazis.
Project Apollo put a person on the moon.
It's one small step for man.
And hastened the defeat of the Soviet Union.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Today, I think that Western supply chains are more vulnerable to China than most people realize.
Let's say China.
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 The question that I kind of have is, does the U.S. even want to stay a superpower?
China.
Welcome to the Minerals Manhattan Project. I'm your host, Emily Hirsch, and I'm joined today by Cassandra Garrison, who's the Argentina correspondent for Reuters and one of my best friends. Hi, Cassandra. How are you doing today?
Hello. I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited.
I'm excited too. So welcome to the Minerals Manhattan Project. And I think probably some of my listeners are going to get excited and think what we're going to talk about is Argentina and lithium. But you know what, Cassandra? They'd be wrong.
We'll save that for another day. We've got other food for five.
Cassandra, the reason I wanted to approvitar, I'm thinking in Spanish, of your expertise is some recent news that's kind of been big, I'd say, in some of the wonky political, geopolitical circles about the Inter-American Development Bank and the leadership there. But I've seen some interesting crossovers with what's happening in that world and what's happening in the critical minerals world. So why all of a sudden, first of all, what is the Inter-American Development Bank and why are people talking about it right now?
Well, I'm so excited to be on to talk about this because, yes, when was the last time we talked about drama surrounding the IDB, right? We don't usually even think about the IDB as a geopolitical battleground, but it's morphed into this really dramatic drama over the presidency of the bank. So first of all, the Inter-American Development Bank is a lending institution for Latin America. It is headquartered in the United States, but traditionally it has been managed. The president has always been somebody from Latin America since its founding in 1959. So there's been kind of this gentleman's agreement that the president would always be a Latin American candidate. But well, you know, some would argue that, you know, Europe has the IMF and the U.S. has the World Bank, and the IDB is kind of Latin America's baby. It's a very respected multilateral institution. It is very important. It's responsible for about $12 billion in financing to Latin America per year. And it's a very well-respected institution that offers a lot of development advice. And again, it's kind of a pride and joy position for LATAM.
Give me a bit of context. $12 billion a year. That sounds like a lot of money for me. But if the IADB, or in Spanish, the BID, is chunking $12 billion a year into Latin America, why haven't mining investors heard of it?
Well, it's $12 billion. I mean, it's not a tiny amount, but it's also not by any stretch the largest lender to Latin America. I mean, the IMF gave Argentina alone a $57 billion financing package.
You know, that went really well.
Yeah, we all know how that ended. Actually, it hasn't ended yet. That saga continues. But I digress. So it's not the biggest lender. I mean, China definitely outlends the IDB as well, and we'll get into all of that. But again, it's important for symbolic reasons. And just $12 billion is substantial, and it does go towards funding some important projects. Argentina was one of the biggest borrowers last year. So what's happening and why there's drama is because the U.S., for the first time ever now, has nominated its own candidate to run the bank. And again, this would be the first time that the U.S. has done this, first time that there's been any candidate from outside Latin America. And this just threw some LATAM countries in a total tailspin. The candidate is Mauricio Clavar Corone. He's a National Security Council advisor to Latin America, you know, pretty well known for pretty tough stances on Cuba, Venezuela. He's sort of the man behind the maximum pressure strategies. I mean, basically, you know, unwilling to necessarily negotiate with Maduro, sanctions not out of the question, isolation policies. Some would argue ineffectively, at least when it comes to Venezuela. So, you know, he has friends and foes, and this is not a secret. And he's outspoken about that as well. He invites someone to debate him. I mean, he doesn't mind opposition. He thinks opposition is a great way to talk about the issues. So he's well aware that he ruffles feathers and he doesn't really apologize for it. So it's no surprise that there's countries in LATAM that oppose him. And I mean, I could explain to you why Argentina in particular has kind of a fraught relationship with him. But yeah, he's an interesting choice. He does have a lot of policy experience. I mean, he certainly is well known in LATAM. He's the U.S. base for LATAM diplomacy. And he wants this position. He thinks that it would be good for the region in terms of the promise of more U.S. capital to the bank, more lending for LATAM. He loves to tout his record of various projects he's done and different initiatives, including a new one called Back to the Americas, which we can talk about too. It's a nearshoring and reshoring initiative. America Crece, which I think the U.S. government launched last year too, which was another way to just get more U.S. investment in LATAM, which sounds great. It sounds like a nice thing that, you know, the U.S. is doing, but this all boils down to China and countering China. And the U.S. talks about that as well. When I spoke to Mauricio Clavercrone, he wouldn't acknowledge that his candidacy is directly meant to get the U.S. a bigger foot in the door in order to counter China. But he did talk about how lending, you know, transparency among Chinese lending practices was one of his main priorities. So
we've got this guy, Mauricio Clavercrone. Sounds a bit Trumpy, wants to make America great again. Those are all things, starving Cuba, starving Venezuela, starving in like the trade sense, like blockades and quarantines.
Yes, he's Cuban-American, by the way.
Okay, so he's a Cuban-American guy. He's in Trump's inner circle, it sounds like. He's done initiatives. What are kind of like the, I'm going to get into the China stuff, so I'm going to, let me tee it up. What are the feathers in his cap? Like, what are the successes that this guy's done besides sound kind of like an asshole on YouTube?
Right. So one of the big things that he's now touting as part of his, I guess, campaign for the IDB presidency is this new whole of government initiative called Back to the Americas. So this is a U.S.
But is that a past success or is that a future plan?
Well, there's already been a few announcements, like, for example, Colombia is getting a big investment as kind of one of the pioneering countries towards this. But no, I mean,
who's giving that money? I'm very confused.
It's a whole government initiative.
But like, is it just like Trump just puts a bunch of money in a box and is like, hey, like, how does it get there?
You'd have to follow the paper trail pretty closely. So I don't know exactly if there's, you know, a piggy bank for LATAM spending that Back to the Americas is using, because actually he was really kind of murky when it came to the financial incentives. He promised that was all coming and these were going to be announcements that were made. But for example, America Crece, it's hard to know exactly how much has gone into that program. That's something that the government launched last year. So this, again, it's just responsible. It's just lending to U.S. or to U.S. allies in LATAM for things like energy, infrastructure.
The reason I'm pushing on this is because I work in LATAM in critical minerals. And like, I don't know anyone who's received these financings and I don't know who to even begin to talk to about them. It quite frankly, you know, we're going to get missiled by saying this, but sometimes it reminds me of trying to do work in Argentina, where you're kind of like figuring out the rumors about who's got the thing. If there's a plan to finance energy infrastructure, mining, mineral processing in Latin America, I can name off the top of my head 10 projects that were financed directly by China. I cannot name one.
Well, that's been a big criticism as well. And Clavercrone, by the way, is well aware of that. And he loves to bring that up when you talk to him about why now is the U.S. putting a candidate forward. He says, well, for the past decade, people have criticized the U.S. for not being involved. Here's our chance to get more involved. And just to be clear, like these programs we're discussing, America Crece and Back to the Americas, that one's brand new. They haven't really been around that long. So I think that's why you haven't seen a major impact. And even still, it's not like the dollar amounts we're talking to are really scratching the surface of China, which of course has lent and in some way, you know, financed something like $140 billion worth of projects in Latin America. But to be fair, that's since, you know, early 2000s, something like 2005. But yeah, massive, massive projects worth, you know, some just billions, just absolute billions, infrastructure, energy, transportation, all kinds of things in LATAM. China is ready and willing with the wallet open in a way that the U.S. has not been, especially under the Trump administration.
Sticking on the theme of China, one of the interesting differences between how China finances infrastructure and energy versus mining and critical minerals in Latin America that I've seen is that when you've got like the dam projects or the large energy, the space base that you covered pretty heavily over the last couple of years projects, those I think are directly financed by the Chinese government or the Chinese government directly backing a company. But with the critical minerals, so in the mining and the critical mineral space, and I'm going to use lithium as the example that just I know, you don't see the Chinese government directly backing a lithium project the same way I think you see it with these other Belt and Road initiatives. You see the Chinese government providing preferential financing terms to Chinese companies in that critical area. And so you have almost a more free market capitalistic approach from the Chinese government, whereby they're not trying to, you know, take over the private sector's role in developing expertise in and owning these projects. They're simply giving Chinese companies an advantage. Do you, and when I see somebody kind of, so when I see the kind of the back to the Americas, America Crece stuff, you know, are we seeing the U.S. government directly coming in and thinking they're going to take the role of private companies in this? Or is there an initiative? I'm curious because, you know, again, I frequently have this conversation where they're like, what can we do about minerals? And you're like,
the idea is to work with the private sector. And again, this hasn't been officially unveiled by the U.S. government. This is something that Clever Crone was kind of revealing bits and pieces of in a couple of interviews that we had with him. And they're talking about it more now. But for example, what financial incentives are there for the U.S. to lure these U.S. companies out of Asia and then either reshore in the U.S. or nearshore in LATAM?
And a lot of these technologies, Cassandra, like these technologies were developed in Asia and they've been growing in China for 20 years. So I don't know what reshoring means when the last time that they produced technology, you know, it was a fax machine.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point to be made. I mean, one of the things he said that was kind of, you know, maybe a bit of the carrot on the stick for U.S. companies is the opportunity to work in a country or an environment, either the U.S. or LATAM, with, you know, more friendly regulatory policies, you know, more of a bedrock for innovation. I mean, you'd have to ask the companies if they agree with that, but they're trying to just, they're trying to basically entice them to come back. You know, there's a lot of, the Caribbean was one of the places he talked about a lot as having a lot of potential. Colombia as well is going to be a pioneering part of this program. So yeah, in terms of what they're actually offering financially, it's hard to say. He did point to an example that Japan did. It's called the Exit China Initiative, and it's pretty recent, actually. Japan met, it's specifically out of China, whereas the U.S. program is kind of generally Asia. But Japan managed to lure some 87 companies to re-headquarter out of China back into Japan. And it was only through some like $650 million in financial incentives, which isn't a huge amount of money.
That is less than $12 billion.
Yeah. So, and then getting 87 companies to come back. So that was the model that Clever Crone pointed to. And again, we asked him, are there any specific companies that you can name? Are there any, you know, sectors that are going to be the primary focus? He didn't get too specific. He mentioned pharmaceuticals. He mentioned energy, transportation. He actually specifically mentioned Vaca Muerta, which is the, you know, giant shale oil deposit in Argentina, which of course has just been a point of contention for years, really something that the government has struggled to capitalize on and struggled to actually tap into those resources and then get them out of Argentina. And they need help doing that. And so you know, building transportation in order to transport those resources was one of the things he mentioned as an area of possibility. He didn't say that they were specifically going to focus on it, but he also talked about Kodak. Recently, Kodak accepted.
So that is, yeah, that is an interesting Kodak. Kodak is a chemical, you know, they do have the pieces in play to be a chemicals company. But it's, I guess the Kodak example is one of the ones where I see the United States, and I know this is not Cassandra's fault, but I see the United States and basically the Trump administration acting like a communist Russian, like, state power from the freaking Cold War. You know, this is, it's exactly what, like, the old white dudes who cry and pull their hair out over the fact they're like, well, I'm scared of socialism. Fine. But when they talk about, like, a state down approach, I mean, no competitiveness, no clarity about what the government is doing. And they're like, oh, so we're going to give a bunch of money to Kodak. And you're like, what?
Yeah, well, it is a loan. But yeah, it's,
but even then, it's like, okay, you want to promote a sector, give preferential terms to people in the sector, some kind of a weird sweetheart deal between a dead film company and the federal government. Like, that is so Soviet. That's the most Soviet thing I think I've seen in my lifetime.
Well, I think that the U.S. is trying to come up with ways to compete with China, which is a hard thing to do.
And they're acting like the Soviet Union in doing it in ways. I guess I'm being intentionally throwing fuel on a fire or whatever. But oh, like, I know I'm usually much more diplomatic. My career as diplomat is aging out in front of me. But no, it just seems like, okay, I think you know my opinions on the human nature and aspects of the current government. But I think Trump's right on China. I think China is a huge threat to the way of life that I've grown accustomed to living, to democracy, to all kinds of things. But then when you've got someone who's like, right, I think China's a problem. I think we need to streamline regulatory processes. We need to make timelines clear in the Minerals Extraction Agency. All of these things are things that, like, I don't just agree with. I'm like, yes, sign me up. How do I help? But then they're like, so we're going to give a giant loan to Kodak. And you're like, what? That's nuts. That's not helping the problem. Or when you're like, okay, China's getting into the critical minerals, lithium, graphite, cobalt, rare earths. And I'm like, great. Yes. Executive order, Trump. Like, let's go do that. Let's go do it in Latin America. And then they're like, so we're going to lend a bunch of money to build infrastructure for oil and gas at the bottom of the earth. And you're like, what? Like, and I kind of have this kind of, you know, everyone's like, meme, so sad. Like, oil and gas companies, no more coal. And you're like, yeah, because those are old technologies.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting approach. And I do think that that's going to be kind of the model that Back to the Americas looks like. It's going to be financial incentives. Yeah, it is. What those financial incentives will be 100% has yet to be seen. But again, the Kodak model, I think, is going to be closer to what it is than not.
Not great, Cassandra. Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I think it's important to reiterate that they're far behind. Okay, they've lost, you know, financing, technology, all of these things. These are battlegrounds between the U.S. and China and LATAM. And China's really in the lead. I mean, honestly, I think I can objectively say that. They certainly outpace the U.S. in lending. And lending is critical. These are emerging markets. These are countries that desperately need infrastructure, desperately need technology, and desperately need trade partners, right, to capitalize on their exports. So this is crucial in terms of not just their finances, but obviously that translates to diplomacy, that translates to favors down the road. And you see that all the time. I mean, even in the coronavirus pandemic, China was just doling out what we called medical diplomacy left, right, and center way before the U.S. kind of reacted to that. It took a reaction to do the same thing, essentially.
Well, everyone knows that coronavirus is a hoax, so.
That's a different podcast, I think.
Because, you know, I want to kind of, when we talk about how China lends to Latin America, can you explain the difference between Like the, as I understand it, like the Belt and Road Initiative and how China lends to Latin America is very asset backed. So if country doesn't pay back loan, China gets asset. That's not how the US loans, right?
Right. So China, first of all, lends, just the sheer magnitude of what they lend to LATAM is so much greater than what the US can offer, and in massive chunks as well. So for example, you know, 300, 350 million at a time. The Qatari Solar Park in Argentina is one of those examples, at very, very low interest rates. One of the issues, though, much lower interest rates than what the U.S. can offer and what the U.S.'s OPIC program can offer.
OPIC is now DFC.
Yes.
It was the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Yes. DFC is the Development Finance Corporation?
That sounds right. Although I don't know off the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to say with 100% accuracy what the acronyms stand for. But basically, it's meant to be like the new and improved OPIC, okay? And it's, again, you know, meant to expand with the effort to offer something in alternative to China.
So what was the difference? So the OPIC... Not OPEC, OPIC. I also, fun story, I went through an entire conference once with people telling me about OPIC, and I had no idea what it was. It was a Bloomberg conference on renewable energy. And I got like, I met like 10 friends that worked there, and they're probably all listening to this being like, you're a jerk, Emily. But I was like, cool, I love OPIC. And I was like, I have to Google this soon. But I was in a basement, I didn't have internet. Like, it was no connection.
Yeah, so it was basically the US answer to Chinese lending. I'd have to look into when it was actually launched, to be honest with you. I wouldn't be able to say.
Okay. So OPIC, though, it's U.S., it's not multinational, and it's private investment corporation. In the past, they could only do loans, and they were very picky about countries being poor enough to be eligible to even start. The DFC, which is like the new and improved OPIC, two of the big changes is that they are going to invest equity, not just debt. And they have allegedly, according to my sources, who are your sources, because we know the same people, have said that they're doing so, they're essentially thinking more about creating rules so that more Latin American countries can qualify for this.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Is this part of the like back to America, is America Crece, or is it kind of all random?
I mean, I don't think they're directly connected. I'd have to really check to find out if there's links between those two. But I mean, it's all part of the same push. It's all part of the same idea. It's all part of the same push. It's a way for the U.S. to get in closer to its allies, to lend them the help that they need, to be there for them when they don't want China to be there for them.
Is Claver Carone leading this push? Like, who is the like?
Well, OPIC's a separate organization. But when it comes to America Crece and Back to the Americas, yes, he is one of the architects behind these programs. And it's interesting because NSC has different levels of influence in various administrations. But under the Trump administration, Claver Carone, as an NSC advisor, is incredibly involved. He is part of the NSC. He's head of the Western Hemisphere's Affairs Department. And he's incredibly involved when it comes to diplomacy and also economic growth. So he's involved in these programs, and he loves to talk about it as part of his track record for what he's done for LATAM.
What has he done for LATAM?
Well, these programs that we're talking about. I mean,
I don't know of them though. So what has he done for LATAM?
He's the face of diplomacy. I mean, he's again, like very much involved in these, in the U.S. policy on Cuba and Venezuela. Those are probably his, you know, what he's most known for is those hardline stances, again, you know, maximum pressure, isolating the Maduro government. So that is what he's most known for. But he's also involved in other projects around the region behind the scenes. For example, one that the U.S. government just unveiled, you know, a $5 billion investment in Colombia to develop rural areas. It's going to be one of the first kind of puzzle pieces towards this Back to the Americas initiative. And they're going to play, an important role in that. So their allies, U.S. allies in LATAM, are going to greatly benefit from the Mauricio Claver Carone friendship.
My confusion here is that, like, he's, I assume, late 40s, early 50s, at least.
It seems like he's kind of on the younger side. He's an attorney. So he has had other roles, but he was previously an advisor, I believe, on international affairs in the Treasury Department. He was also a U.S. representative, U.S. executive, and the IMF. So he's not, you know, it's not like he has no track record.
I just don't hear of anything that so for example, when you're like China, they built this solar park, they built this space station, they built this highway system. Like, to me, that's a track record.
Yes. Yeah. China's track record versus Mauricio Clavero-Caron's track record in LATAM, not exactly comparable. And to be honest with you, also, like, it's not necessarily typical that, in fairness to him, that an NSC official is really out in front center in public. You know, he gives a lot of interviews to LATAM media.
I'm still confused about what the NSC is, and I am not just giving you a hard time. I am from Washington, D.C.
They advise on, you know, U.S. security policy, and they're responsible for U.S. security policy, but also, you know, in turn, it depends on the administration, but the NSC under Trump plays a lot of role in development as well, especially in LATAM.
Do you remember the Schoolhouse Rock where they're like, a bill becomes law?
We need one for the NSC.
I really would like one of those for modern. I'm not kidding. I would watch that.
I think a lot of adults in the United States of America would benefit from those.
But I also think a lot of people pretend to know what stuff is, like I did with OPIC.
Oh gosh, we're all just here to keep track of U.S. government programs and organizations, and you know, it just we get it mixed up.
I mean, I consider myself fairly knowledgeable on things, but I also like, okay, we've got back to the Americas, we've got America Crece, we've got a DFC program. Like, somebody surely must be organizing them to communicate with each other.
Yeah, there's definitely, you can count on there being a WhatsApp chat about all this stuff.
I hope so, Cassandra. Frankly, because I think it's frustrating for those of us in the minerals and the battery supply chain space to see announcements, you know, and then we're like, okay, 1 year to the next year, does the U.S. have more security of these critical mineral supply chains? And you're like, no. And you're like, do they have a plan? And they're like, they bought Kodak. And you're like, what? That's confusing.
Yeah. I mean, yes, right. It's hard to track this stuff, and it's hard to see where it makes a dent. And I think that's one of the, that's something that at least Clavero-Caron is conscious of. He directly addresses that when he talks about, you know, his plans, his goals, and also his track record in LATAM. He wants the U.S. to be more involved. He thinks that he's one of the things he likes to say is that his candidacy represents a great commitment on the part of the U.S. to the IDB. You know, that's going to come with some probably capital increase for the bank, some clout for the bank. He's going to have a really, you know, diverse cabinet. And there's also, interestingly enough, there's a lot of theories about his candidacy. So I don't know how much you want to get into the drama around it. But one of the interesting things that some sources told me on the LATAM government side, I mean, it was an Argentine government official. They really think that this whole candidacy of Clavero-Caron is a ploy by the Trump administration to win voters in Florida ahead of his, you know, ahead of the November election. Clavero-Caron is he's a Rubio guy. Okay. He's popular in Florida. His position on Cuba is popular among Cuban Americans, Cuban immigrants in Florida. So yeah, this could be kind of a bargaining chip that Trump has to win over Florida, which is a crucial state. However, that's just one theory. Okay. Also, China obviously is going to play a role in this, but Clavero-Caron treats it like this is a passion project for him. It's also, you know, potentially a parachute out of the Trump administration.
I want to just get a couple of nuts and bolts sorted before I advance with the conspiracy theories.
Sure.
Maybe I should ask for the end of my podcast people to tell me a conspiracy theory that they don't not believe. No, but Cassandra, so they blocked, as I understand just the timeline, which, you know, now that everyone's listened to this, they'll hear this and want to listen to it again. The timeline was the U.S. nominated him, people tried to get the vote delayed. Did Guyana end up nominating him?
Oh, yeah. But although they're not the only ones, Haiti, El Salvador, Paraguay as well have all actually also nominated him as their candidate as well, which is.
Listen, Paraguay still recognizes Taiwan as China. Fun Paraguay fact.
True. Yes. One of the few.
One of the few.
Yes.
But they nominated him or they accepted his U.S. nomination. Is there a difference?
No. They co-nominated him as their candidate as well. There's, just to be clear, there's 17 countries in LATAM and the Caribbean that have publicly supported Claver Corone. So he needs the support of 15 out of 28 countries. He already has it. Okay. He has it. So the only hope that the opposition has, which includes countries like Argentina, Mexico, Chile, and Costa Rica, they have come out in support of delaying the election. Yes. Well, they want to delay the election for two reasons. First of all, the reason on paper is that they don't think he's a good choice because he's a candidate from outside the region. It's a break in an important tradition for LATAM. And also, some of them have cited the coronavirus pandemic preventing them from having ample time to weigh all their choices, have debates in a democratic way, and really move forward in this process as they normally would. So they all need more time. The vote is virtual, by the way, which is Claver Corone's biggest argument against delaying it. So, however, this also is interesting when they want to delay it to most say March of 2021, because obviously that's well after the U.S. election in November. Okay. A lot of countries think that it's highly probable that Trump could lose the White House. So, A, why would you want to vote for a candidate who's no longer going to have any kind of influence in its own government's administration?
Well, he's got such a fucking great track record, Cassandra.
Well, that's what he says, right? He says he's willing to work with any administration. He's not concerned if there's a change of administration after November. He will at that point, he's no longer a U.S. government official. He's an IDB president, and it will be his job to be diplomatic and work with whoever he needs to work with. That's his argument. Now, he does have a significant amount of opposition against his candidacy in the United States as well. So it's a harder argument for him to make. But also U.S. allies, I don't know why all of them have endorsed him, the 15 out of the 20, 17 out of the 28. It may be that they really do believe that he is would be a great candidate for the bank, as he says. Or do they feel, somewhat bullied, somewhat pressured to support him? The U.S. under current administration can sometimes be, I don't want to say vengeful, but they can.
No, I think there is consensus. And like, this is where I was getting with this. I think there is consensus even among real Trumpy people that like Trump likes people who like Trump and dislikes people who dislike Trump, regardless of their policies. Like I said, I don't think you could find somebody more aligned with the let's do something about China. I am so online with that, but I also think that Donald Trump is a flaming trash bag of a human being. I think he's a bad guy. Therefore, I don't think I'd ever get an appointment there, even if I were the most competent person to like do mineral stuff. I love mining into minerals, make regulations clear, streamline them, get people in the government who have experience working in industry, all of those things. Like, I'm so aligned with those things that I started a freaking podcast about it.
Right. Well, yes. And I think, I think LATAM countries, their even close allies, would be very hesitant to come out against Claver Corone for potential repercussions now or later. However, Mexico did. Okay. So Mexico, even though AMLO had a great visit with Trump not that long ago, did end up coming out in support of a delay. There was a lot of debate who Mexico would support. Would it be Claver Corone? Would it be Argentina's candidate, Gustavo Belis? They actually have, at this point, given their support to Belis, the Argentine candidate, and called for a delay. So that was, that's a tightrope that Mexico was walking with the U.S. relationship, but that's what they chose in the end.
So if then let's say that Claver Corone takes the day, becomes the president of the IADB, is on a WhatsApp chat or a Zoom call or maybe a Telegram group with the guy or lady, the person in charge of America Cresce, and then Jared Kushner's college roommate who's now running the DFC.
All right.
That's who it is.
Oh boy.
Not joking. But does he become somebody who post-Trump can unite? I mean, I think we should all agree that maybe Make America Suck Less at Minerals is a hat we'd all wear.
Yeah, he's going to have to work with the U.S. I mean, he's going to have to get, you know, U.S. support by the Treasury to increase any kind of capital in the IDB. It's going to take relationships. It's going to take diplomacy. He's also going to have to work with countries who desperately need the IDB, like Argentina, which is now on kind of his, you know, foe list.
Listen, honestly, nobody should be lending to Argentina right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, Argentina is not in a good spot. But the very tricky diplomatic issue for Argentina is that they really need the U.S. right now. OK, they're about to renegotiate their IMF package. They need U.S. support. Coronavirus has just completely battered Argentina even further than it had already been. We all know Argentina's situation. OK, coronavirus didn't do it any favors. It's going to need serious, serious help in the coming years. OK, its economy is just in tatters at this point. So the IDB is going to be important to Argentina, and it was last year as well. They had they have a difficult relationship with Claver Corone. He walked out of Fernandez's inauguration. He boycotted it in December because a Maduro government official was present. So, you know, they have kind of a difficult, there's some strain between,
I mean, a bunch of pompous men in suits throwing temper tantrums at each other. Like, okay. Like, I mean, look, that's politics. One other thing is making business decisions. And like, at the end of the day, lending has to be a business decision.
Yes.
Lending to Argentina has not proven to be a smart business decision.
No, it has not. But they still manage to leverage certain resources like the IDB. That's what the IDB is there for. Argentina is going to have to make a lot of changes to increase investor confidence and get lending in the future. But I don't know. Yeah, that's also an entire podcast on itself.
That's another podcast. Well, listen, Cassandra, we will definitely have you back on the Minerals Manhattan Project to talk about other things.
This was really fun.
I'm glad. And we can talk about Argentina. I know you really love to get into the nitty gritty of the debt crisis.
I live and die macro, baby. You know it.
So if people want more Cassandra Garrison, where can they find you on the internet? Besides, I think they could probably Google Cassandra Reuters.
Yes, I there's not many of us, even fewer in Argentina. So my Twitter handle is at Cassel Garrison. It's CASSLGARRISON. And all of my work is posted there. So if you're an Argentina watcher or even just LATAM, general geopolitics stuff, you can find a lot of stuff there that we're working on.
Cool. Well, listen, this has been the Minerals Manhattan Project. I'm your host, Emily Hirsch. You can find me on Twitter at Lithium Podcast. You can find me on LinkedIn I think Google Emily Lithium as well. I think that one I come up on, Cassandra Reuters. And I am on LinkedIn. I published some stuff with the Payne Institute at the Colorado School of Mines. I look forward to, I have a website, www.batterymaterials.energy. And this podcast is available at www.mineralsmanhattanproject and Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and basically anywhere that somebody would want to find a podcast. You can find it. If you don't, send me a message and I will sort that out. So listen, Cassandra, I will let you go back to reading about the minutia of movements in the Argentine bond market.
Oh yeah, thank you. My light reading this weekend. Yeah.
And gotta keep it fun for the weekend. I will talk to you later, and thank you so much for sharing what's going on with this Make America Do Something. Maybe.
Something like that. Close enough. Thanks for having me.
The Minerals Manhattan Project is hosted by Emily Hirsch and produced by Emily Hirsch and Elena Peach. To continue today's conversation, Follow Emily on Twitter at Lithium Podcast and visit our website at batterymaterials.energy. Enjoyed today's episode? Please share with others and rate the Minerals Manhattan Project on wherever you get your podcasts. Have content suggestions or interested in being featured as a guest in a future episode? Please contact us via our website or the Twitters.